The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Lisa Zeidner from Rutgers University. I'm going to be introducing William Gibson tonight. The library has asked me to remind you, no cell phones, even if you have a sitter with a very young kid or a major business deal closing in the next 30 minutes. No flash photography in the hall. I'm delighted to introduce William Gibson tonight. He's with us only partially bleary-eyed from Vancouver in time for the paperback release of his seventh novel, Pattern Recognition, a book that actually has a great deal to say about the quintessential 20th century condition of jet lag. He's a long way from Vancouver, and he's also, with Pattern Recognition, a long way from where he started with his first book, Neuromancer, in 1984. That novel, 20 years ago, the only novel to ever win the Hugo, Nebula, and Philip K. Dick Awards in the same year, made him a cult hero for readers of science fiction. It also gave him the distinction, or the curse, maybe, if you're the novelist and have to hear it about 30 million times, of being identified as the guy who coined the term cyberspace. Given the fact that the rest of us were still using IBM Selectrics in 1984, William Gibson's penetration about the ways that electronic culture would transform us seems downright visionary. Perhaps no novelist has captured better or written more eloquently about the fantastical destabilizing speed of changes in the way we communicate and the weird loneliness at the heart of all that instant access. A warning, though. If you go on his website and listen in on the conversations of his 2,263 last time I looked registered members, you'll hear a lot about Blade Runner, The Matrix, and other science fiction films, a dark and threatening world full of flashing, violently flashing neon, futuristic skyscrapers, time-bending, and the like. While his novels share a milieu with some of this work, they have always, in my opinion, been strongly novels of character, about full people responding to their environments, filtering what they see and experience through their own distorting lenses. And nowhere is that more the case than with Pattern Recognition, the least futuristic of his novels, in fact, the first set totally in the present. The most science fiction-like event referenced in Pattern Recognition is 9/11, which, he suggests, is sci-fi enough. Quote, we have no future because the present is too volatile. Case Pollard, the super hip heroine of Pattern Recognition, is a cool hunter, someone skilled at predicting trends and penetrating subcultures. And so, of course, is William Gibson himself. A lot of the pleasure of his fiction has to do with the wonderfully textured glosses he makes on the contemporary scene. But he isn't a journalist or a stock analyst. While it may seem like a bizarre comparison, I would suggest that Harry Angstrom, the car salesman of John Updike novels, who I know many of you heard earlier this year, when he steps foot into a new car and begins to speak of his inchoate yearnings, it's not a totally different universe than when Case reacts to a mini Hummer. At the heart of pattern recognition is a question about whether any of us can have a pure experience anymore, or whether we've been advertised and reality TV'd right out of our own lives. Or, as he puts it, all experience has been reduced by the spectral hand of marketing to price point variations of the same thing. Case in point, here William Gibson creates a character named Case who is allergic to brand names, who sands the logos off the buttons of her Levi jeans, and who will only wear a very specific and expensive and very hard-to-find Buzz Rixon flyer jacket. Now I learn from a fan on the website that a store in Tokyo is actually selling this very jacket for a phenomenally inflated price to crazy Western tourists, and the jacket comes with a picture of William Gibson wearing the jacket in the pocket of the coat, along with a copy of a letter he wrote to the guy who manufactures the jacket. Talk about life imitating art and thickly layered ironies. And are we so very far there from the plot of Idoru that involves people falling in love with virtual media stars? May I just add that sentence by sentence, few contemporary writers can provide as many pleasures as William Gibson. There's a succulent crispness to his diction, a density and depth to his description, and a wryness to his dialogue that makes it always fascinating to land in his world, as I'm sure you'll hear tonight. Please join me in welcoming William Gibson.
Thank you. That was easily the best introduction I've ever had to a reading. Okay, I'm going to read the. I'm sort of nearing the end of my book tour for this, so I'm going to read the first chapter. And in the way of things, it might actually be the last time that I ever read the first chapter. And I lived with this chapter for, I don't know, almost 2 years, and there wasn't anything else there. And it was more or less exactly as it is now. And I had no idea who this woman was or what her problem was. Well, you know, I just knew she was there, and she had this, unaccountable, weird affect. And I decided that I knew that part of it was probably jet lag, but something else had happened to her, and I really didn't know what. And when I think about that now, having written the book, it makes me feel like I'm insane. But that's just the nature of the process. And this is called The Website of Dreadful Night. 5 hours New York jet lag in case Pollard wakes in Camden Town to the dire and ever-circling wolves of disrupted circadian rhythm. It is that flat and spectral non-hour awash in limbic tides, brainstem stirring fitfully, flashing inappropriate reptilian demands for sex, food, sedation, all of the above, and none really an option now. Not even food, as Damien's new kitchen is as devoid of edible content as its designer's display windows in Camden High Street. Very handsome, the upper cabinets faced in canary yellow laminate, the lower with lacquered unstained apple ply. Very clean and almost entirely empty, save for a carton containing 2 dry pucks of Weetabix and some loose packets of herbal tea. Nothing at all in the German fridge, so new that its interior smells only of cold and long-chain monomers. She knows now, absolutely, hearing the white noise that is London, that Damien's theory of jet lag is correct, that her mortal soul is leagues behind her, being reeled in on some ghostly umbilical down the vanished wake of the plane that brought her here, hundreds of thousands of feet above the Atlantic. Souls can't move that quickly and are left behind and must be awaited upon arrival like lost luggage. She wonders if this gets gradually worse with age. The nameless hour deeper, more null, its affect at once stranger and less interesting. Numb here in the semi-dark in Damien's bedroom beneath a silvery thing the color of oven mitts, probably never intended by its makers to actually be slept under. She'd been too tired to find a blanket. The sheets between her skin and the weight of this industrial coverlet are silky, some luxurious thread count, and they smell faintly of, she guesses, Damien. Not badly, though. Actually, it's not unpleasant. Any physical linkage to a fellow mammal seems a plus at this point. Damien is a friend. Their boy-girl Lego doesn't click, he would say. Damien is 30, Case 2 years older, but there is some carefully insulated module of immaturity in him, some shy and stubborn thing that frightens the money people. Both have been very good at what they've done, neither seeming to have the least idea of why. Google Damien and you'll find a director of music videos and commercials. Google Case and you'll find Cool Hunter, and if you look closely, you may see it suggested that she is a sensitive of some kind. a dowser in the world of global marketing. Though the truth, Damien would say, is closer to allergy, a morbid and sometimes violent reactivity to the semiotics of the marketplace. Damien's in Russia now, avoiding renovation and claiming to be shooting a documentary. Whatever faintly lived-in feel this place now has, Case knows, is the work of a production assistant. She rolls over, abandoning this pointless parody of sleep, gropes for her clothes, a small boy's black Fruit of the Loom t-shirt, thoroughly shrunken, a thin gray v-necked pullover purchased by the half dozen from a supplier of New England prep schools, and a new and oversized pair of black 501s, every trademark carefully removed. Even the buttons on these have been ground flat, featureless, by a puzzled Korean locksmith in the village a week ago. The switch on Damien's Italian floor lamp feels alien, a different click, designed to hold back a different voltage, foreign British electricity. Standing now, stepping into her jeans, she straightens, shivering. Mirror world. The plugs on appliances are huge, triple-pronged, for a species of current that only powers electric chairs in America. Cars are reversed, left to right, inside. Telephone handsets have a different weight, a different balance. The covers of paperbacks look like Australian money. Pupils contracted painfully against sunbright halogens, she squints into an actual mirror canted against a gray wall, awaiting hanging, wherein she sees a black-legged, disjointed puppet sleep hair poking up like a toilet brush. She grimaces at it, thinking for some reason of a boyfriend who'd insisted on comparing her to Helmut Newton's nude portrait of Jane Birkin. In the kitchen, she runs tap water through a German filter into an Italian electric kettle, fiddles with switches, one on the kettle, one on the socket, blankly surveys the canary expanse of laminated cabinetry while it boils, bag of some imported Californian tea substitute and a large white mug, pouring boiling water. In the flat's main room, she finds that Damien's faithful cube is on, but sleeping, the nightlight glow of its static switches pulsing gently. Damien's ambivalence toward design showing here. He won't allow decorators through the door unless they basically agree not to do that which they do, yet he holds on to this Mac for the way you can turn it upside down and remove its innards with a magic little aluminum handle, like the sex of one of the robot girls in his video, now that she thinks of it. She seats herself in his high-backed workstation chair and clicks the transparent mouse, stutter of infrared on the pale, pale wood of the long trestle table. The browser comes up. She types fetish footage forum, which Damien, determined to avoid contamination, will never bookmark. The front page opens, familiar as a friend's living room. A frame grab from number 48 serves as backdrop, dim and almost monochrome, no characters in view. This is one of the sequences that generate comparisons with Tarkovsky. She only knows Tarkovsky from stills, really, though she did once fall asleep during a screening of The Stalker. Going under on an endless pan, the camera aims straight down and close up at a puddle on a ruined mosaic floor. But she is not one of those who think that much will be gained by analysis of the maker's imagined influences. The cult of the footage is rife with subcults, claiming every possible influence. Truffaut, Peckinpah, the Peckinpah people among the least likely are still waiting for the guns to be drawn. She enters the forum itself now, automatically scanning titles of the posts and names of posters in the newer threads, looking for friends, enemies, news. One thing is clear, though, no new footage has surfaced. Nothing since that beach pan, and she does not subscribe to the theory that it is con in winter. French footage heads have been unable to match it, in spite of countless hours recording pans across approximately similar scenery. She also sees that her friend Parkaboy is back in Chicago, home from an Amtrak vacation, California, but when she opens his post, she sees he's only saying hello, literally. She clicks respond, declares herself Case P. Hi, Parkaboy, no text. When she returns to the forum page, her post is there. It is a way now, approximately, of being at home. The forum has become one of the most consistent places in her life, like a familiar cafe that exists somehow outside of geography and beyond time zones. There are perhaps 20 regular posters on FFF, and some much larger, an uncounted number of lurkers. And right now there are 3 people in chat, but there's no way of knowing exactly who until you are in there, and the chat room she finds not so comforting. It's strange even with friends, like sitting in a pitch-dark cellar conversing with people at a distance of about 15 feet. The hectic speed and the brevity of the lines in the thread, plus the feeling that everyone is talking at once at counter-purposes, deter her. The cube sighs softly and makes subliminal sounds with its drive, like a vintage sports car downshifting on a distant freeway. She tries a sip of tea substitute, but it's still too hot. A gray and indeterminate light is starting to suffuse the room in which she sits, revealing such Damiania as has survived the recent remake. Partially disassembled robots are propped against one wall, 2 of them, torsos and heads, like elfin, decidedly female crash test dummies. These are effects units from one of Damien's videos, and she wonders, given her mood, why she finds them so comforting. Probably because they are genuinely beautiful, she decides, optimistic expressions of the feminine. No sci-fi kitsch for Damien. Dreamlike things in the dawn half-light, their small breasts gleaming, white plastic shining faint as old marble. Personally fetishistic, though, she knows he'd had them molded from a body cast of his last girlfriend, -2. Hotmail downloads 4 messages, none of which she feels like opening. Her mother, 3 spam. The penis enlarger is still after her, twice, and increase your breast size dramatically. Deletes spam, sips the tea substitute, watches the gray light becoming more like day. Eventually, she goes into Damien's newly renovated bathroom, feels she could shower down in it prior to visiting a sterile NASA probe, or step out of some Chernobyl scenario to have her lead suit removed by rubber-gowned Soviet technicians, who'd then scrub her with long-handled brushes. The features in the shower can be adjusted with elbows, preserving the sterility of scrubbed hands. She pulls off her sweater and T-shirt, and using hands, not elbows, starts the shower and adjusts the temperature. 4 hours later, she's on a reformer in a Pilates studio in an upscale alley called Neil's Yard, the car and driver from Blue Ant waiting out on whatever street it is. The reformer is a very long, very low, vaguely ominous and Weimar-looking piece of spring-loaded furniture, on which she now reclines, doing V position against the footrail at the end. The padded platform she rests on wheels back and forth along tracks of angle iron within the frame, springs twanging softly. 10 of these, 10 toes, 10 from the heels. In New York, she does this at a fitness center frequented by dance professionals. But here in Neil's Yard this morning, she seems to be the sole client. The place is only recently opened, apparently, and perhaps this sort of thing is not yet so popular here. There is that mirror world ingestion of archaic substances, she thinks. People smoke and drink as though it were good for you, and seem still to be in some sort of honeymoon phase with cocaine. Heroin, she's read, is cheaper here than it's ever been, the market still glutted by the initial dumping of Afghani opium supplies. Done with her toes, she changes to heels, craning her neck to be certain her feet are correctly aligned. She likes Pilates because it isn't, in the way she thinks of yoga, meditative. You have to keep your eyes open here and pay attention. That concentration counters the anxiety she feels now, the pre-job jitters she hasn't experienced in a while. She's here on Blue Ant's ticket, relatively tiny in terms of permanent staff, globally distributed, more post-geographic than multinational. The agency has from the beginning billed itself as a high-speed, low-drag life form in an advertising ecology of lumbering herbivores, or perhaps as some non-carbon-based life form entirely sprung from the smooth and ironic brow of its founder, Hubertus Bigend, a nominal Belgian who looks like Tom Cruise on a diet of virgin's blood and truffled chocolates. The only thing Case enjoys about Bigend is that he seems to have no sense at all that his name might seem ridiculous to anyone, ever. Otherwise, she would find him even more unbearable than she already does. It's entirely personal, though at one remove. Still doing heels, she checks her watch. A Korean clone of an old-school Casio G-Shock. Its plastic case sanded free of logos with a scrap of Japanese micro-abrasive. She is due in Blue Ant's Soho offices in 50 minutes. She drapes a pair of limp green foam pads over the foot rail, carefully positions her feet, lifts them on invisible stiletto heels, and begins her 10 prehensile. Thank you.
A bit, so we have microphones, some of which
work,
and if you would please hold up your hand and wait until the microphone gets to you to ask your question. Any questions? Gentleman back here on the left, or my left.
Yeah, I was just wondering if there's any news on the Chris Cunningham project for Neuromancer, or if you care.
I think that one... I think it's not going to happen. I'm in process of letting go, as we say. But I don't think he's going to be the director. If indeed there's ever going to be a director.
Another question? Back here in the middle.
Of all places, on Friday I'm going to Tokyo. Chiba City. Any suggestions in your comments?
Well, if you're going to Chiba City, I suggest you go downtown and see Tokyo. Chiba City is sort of halfway between the airport and Tokyo, and it's nothing like the Chiba City in Neuromancer. Apparently, there's some metropolitan functionary in Chiba City is like deeply baffled by tourists who keep turning up. But but yeah, my Tokyo. You have to go to Shinjuku at night. That's like, you know, that's the whole thing. That's the pure. Between Shinjuku at night and Shibuya at night, you get the total Blade Runner City hit. And it's totally cool, but my personal recommendation for Tokyo is go to the Shibuya branch of the Tokyu, as opposed to Tokyo, the Tokyu Hands department store, which is like the coolest single retail environment in the world. You don't even have to buy anything; just wander around. If you're like me, it'll just completely blow your mind. I still can't figure out what it's about.
Another question? This gentleman in the middle here.
Thank you. How long did you consciously extend sort of the influencer comparison to Oedipamaz and Crying of Lot 49, if it was a conscious comparison? I know there's been a lot of connections drawn between Oedipamaz and Case Pollard. I was wondering if that was choice, no. And if so, you know, how, you know, superliminal or subliminal or along those lines it was.
It was, you know, if it's not just a case of apophenia on the part of my readers, it was unconscious. It was unconscious on my part. I remember getting quite far through the manuscript, and thinking about remembering, maybe someone will think I'm doing that. But I wasn't conscious. Oh, I know what it was. Actually, this came back to me last night when somebody asked a similar question. When I was unable, when I felt utterly unable to find any closure for this narrative, which was about two-thirds of the way through, and was in maybe even more than my usual panic about how the book would end, I was saying to a friend, well, maybe it just kind of doesn't end. It just kind of rolls out at the end, and it doesn't have to come together, and it's like, I'm doing, you know, it's a literary novel. And my friend said, well, you don't want to do that. It'd be like the crying of Lot 49, and that's like just, you know, such a bummer when you get to the last page. And you know, it's like nobody liked that. And so that was that. Then that became consciously my concern, that I didn't want to have the lottery cried in the next room and nobody ever finds out what the hell it was all about. And that was my most conscious Lot 49 action during the course of writing this.
Another question? Gentleman in front here.
Hi. Is producing artifacts like this an act of rebellion? I mean, are they becoming obsolete? Will they become obsolete soon? And so sticking with this form, is that swimming against the tide somehow? Or do you think they'll never become obsolete?
I don't know. Ask Barnes & Noble. Why are there more bookstores than there have ever been in America? And why do they keep getting bigger and bigger? And why are there more books produced every year? Like, where's it obsoleting? You know, how many people are sitting in Starbucks reading downloaded novels on their PDAs? Some people may be, but I just don't. That's one of the things I would never been able to predict about the early 21st century is the astonishing and unprecedented prevalence of books. There are more books being published now than have ever been published, and there are more retail slots for them. And it's almost as though it's out of control. Maybe it's the kind of some kind of final pyrotechnic end to the world's oldest mass medium, but maybe not. I don't think that you know, switching to whatever limited range I have as like a hard SF guy, I don't think it's particularly a good idea if we go on making as many disposable wood pulp artifacts as we do and not recycling them. But until the reading device is so simple that dogs and children can use it and you can buy it on a bubble pack in 7-Eleven, nothing's going to happen. Because until a piece of technology is available on a bubble pack in 7-Eleven, it's not really available, and that's gonna be a while.
Another question, this gal right here. Question right in front here.
Fragments seem to be of this kind, of one kind or another, seem to be featured in many of your works. And I'm thinking here of Academy Leader or a hologram, or fragments of a hologram rose. Can you address Casey's ability to interpret the fragments of culture and commerce around her? I'm wondering if this is some type of fundamental human trait, or is this uniquely located in Casey's character? And what?
Well, I think that Cases is to some extent one of those animals of Swiftian satire. She has a really, really extreme case of something that I suspect we all have a clinical case of. You know? We all have a little bit of what she's got. It's how we know. I'm more interested in how people know instantly what they're not going to buy when they walk into a shop than how they decide what they're going to buy. It's the decisions they've already made, like never those trousers, never. And like, how do people do that? We have to do that all the time. It's you'd die if you couldn't do that. You'd starve to death. You'd buy a lot of really ugly pants. And so I think it all comes down to pattern recognition. And I don't remember why I chose pattern recognition as the title for this novel, but I know I had a long notebook page with a bunch of really, really hopeless titles, and somehow pattern recognition was there. And I don't know, I don't know where I saw it, but I kept coming back to it. I kept coming back to it, and then I Googled it, and then I looked it up on Amazon.com, and there were only two other books called Pattern Recognition, and they were both textbooks that cost about $300. And I thought that was cool. And the more, and then the pattern recognition Googling led me to a discussion of apophenia. And that really got me going. And I've been fascinated all my life by the sociology of conspiracy theories and how that sometimes seems to connect with how religions work. And it just a lot of things started coming together for me. And the more I thought about it, the more it seemed to me that pattern recognition is the quintessential thing that we do that, as far as we know, distinguishes us from every other species on the planet, or at least the incredibly elaborated extent to which we do it. If you don't have pattern recognition, you can't do spoken language, so you can't do written language. If you don't have pattern recognition, you can't create atemporal artifacts that allow for the transference of human memory outside of the individual. And pattern recognition, it seems to me, is really at the base of this glorious multiplex pickle we find ourselves in here at the beginning of the 21st century. And so Case became, and I loathe the idea of didactic fiction, but she became a sort of tunnel canary for my various experiments within this narrative with pattern recognition. So, you know, when she goes into Harvey Nichols and nearly breaks out in hives from seeing too much Tommy Hilfiger, it's the result of pattern recognition. That's what's happening to her.
Gentleman back here.
Just wanted to know if you wanted to comment on, seems like the one of the things in your book where you have multiple people doing the same thing, some get very highly paid to do it, and some people just seem to do it for free. You've got people like Parker Boy who just seem to volunteer their time to get things done. Do you see that as a trend in the future where you still have the split between people that get paid to do stuff they enjoy and the people that just do it for free?
Well, I think so, yeah. It's one of the things I like about the society of the internet. And I like the idea that there are people that marketers now refer to as prosumers. Prosumers are consumers who know more about the product that you manufacture than you do yourself. And they'll tell you about it. And you find them in mostly in fairly tight, sort of products with a high technical demand, like cameras, watches, firearms. And the smart manufacturers and designers listen to those people, and those people aren't being paid at all. And that's the commercial version of it. But the non-commercial version of it is just purely about information. It's sort of the open. It's more like the open version of being an otaku, where you know everything there is to know about something, and you just live to know more about it, and you live to tell people who know less about it than you do about it in just the most witheringly precise detail. But if you need to know those things, are you know, if you need to know something, if you need to know how many knurls are knurled into the crank handle on the top of the Curta calculator, there's somebody out there who can tell you. You just have to find exactly where to post your query.
All the way in back here.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could say a few words about your literary genealogy and what you read when you were 12.
Well, I think probably the thing, it's like, I don't know, the idea of literary genealogy implies that it's the you know, I don't know if the I'm no longer sure how much I believe in the metaphor. You know, I don't know if it doesn't really work. It doesn't really work like DNA, and if you don't digest your influences, at least if you don't digest them completely, you're in trouble. But I think probably the thing, the 12-year-old reading that most explains the sort of writer I wound up being would be that I'm almost certain that I discovered William Burroughs and Edgar Rice Burroughs in the same year. And I went from reading paperback original genre SF to reading the beat poets in, you know, a matter of months, and I'm really sure if I hadn't done that, I probably wouldn't be here tonight. I'd be in some other library talking about some completely different kind of book I had written in a different city. Or perhaps not at all.
Another question? Right here.
Good evening. What is the wildest actual experience you have been through? In person, live experience.
Well, I don't know, but almost certainly it would be something that my inherent shyness and reserve would keep me from sharing with you this evening.
Next. Lady right back here.
Someone from the boards actually wanted to ask how you feel science fiction has affected technology.
How do I feel science fiction has affected actual technology?
Yes.
Oh, there is a relation. There's some sort of relationship there. I haven't actually had that much to do subculturally, I guess you could say, with science fiction for about 20 years. Like, I don't hang out with the science fiction folks as much as I did at one time, but I know from the time I did spend there when I was younger that there is a kind of feedback loop. The only influence I believe that I had was in an area of a sort of emergent technology that wound up going nowhere at all, and that was virtual reality. And, you know, virtual reality in the sense of the pretty girl with the goggles and the gloves, her hair is blowing, and she's like, And that was a sort of objective correlative for what we do with television and what we do with computers. And it never got anywhere because of what the VR people reluctantly began to call the cootie factor. People didn't want to share the helmet. That's literally true. And they didn't want to wear other people's goggles. But really, it didn't work because you just don't need it. You get in front of your display and you're there. It's in the nature of the medium that you're there. But when VR of the helmet and gloves variety, when various techno hustlers and quasi bohemian computer people were trying to get funding for that, they all carried around multiple copies of Neuromancer because it was really hard for them to explain what they were talking about, and they'd say, "Here, read this." And I know they did that because I know some of those guys, and they told me they were doing it, and they met me because they said, "We have a great debt to you. You make it easy for us to get funding." But generally, I don't think there's as much. The scientific and technological imagination is not very different from the imagination of a certain kind of science fiction writer. Very, very similar, just very similar imagination, except the scientists and technocrats can actually build stuff. I used to, before my audience had widened a little bit, I had a lot more readers, and they would always kind of leave me with a certain sense of despair, because I'd realize that was all they could get out of the books, was the gizmo factor. And the gizmo factor, it was like I had developed a sort of branch plant off to the side of my creative self. It would just whip out these like great little gizmos. It was effortless. It involved no work, and it amused me. And you know, I just seed the story with them, so it would feel like the future. But it wouldn't have come close to satisfying me in terms of being a writer and trying to be creative. I was never paying very much attention to that. And when I'd meet readers who loved my work exclusively for that and didn't get the rest of it, it would, you know, I'd go home sighing and start trying to write another novel. But
gentleman all the way back there.
Hi, yes, I teach a class on utopia and dystopia here at Temple University, and of all the essays that I've read about the decline of modernity, the one that struck me the best is your essay, The Gernsback Continuum. And I was wondering if you'd just say a few words about how you came up with the idea and the setting for that, and also how Blade Runner inspired you, because I've read that you said that you realized that Blade Runner was sort of a transition point for sci-fi.
Actually, it's funny. The Gernsback Continuum is actually a short story rather than an essay, but the reason it seems like an essay is it was originally a book review, which I'd submitted to a science fiction fanzine, and they'd rejected it, and I got angry. And I got angry and rejigged it as a piece of fiction and sold it and got it published. It was a review of a book called The Streamlined Decade, which was very much about that sort of techno-optimistic kitsch stuff that features in the story. And it also worked for me in a sort of found object way when I redid it as some kind of cultural critique of something that I saw science fiction was still doing, and I just thought it was like hopeless and old and should die. I was very, you know, very much in my cyberpunk moment there when I was writing that. And what was the second half of your question? I'm sorry. Oh, Blade Runner. Well, you know, I was about a third or halfway through Neuromancer when Blade Runner was released, and I went to see it in theatrical release as soon as it was out. Lasted about 10 minutes and left the theater virtually in tears, because this English guy had made this astonishingly beautiful looking movie that looked just like the inside of my forehead, but better. And that night, higher resolution and cleverer in some ways. And so, that night I went to bed knowing I would have to abandon my first novel and start over. And I was really unhappy. And it shortly became apparent that Blade Runner in theatrical release was a whopping bomb. Nobody went to see it. It just did terribly. It got awful reviews. Nobody paid any attention to it, and it vanished. And that helped me go on with that helped me go on with Neuromancer. But as Neuromancer, it took a while for Neuromancer to get published. Like, I wrote it in 81 and 82, I think, and it was published in 84. And by 84, Blade Runner was proving to have the most bizarre legs of any film I'd ever seen. It was affecting, you know, people were naming, it was affecting the naming of private dance clubs in London. It was affecting the way younger architects made buildings look. It was affecting fashion. It just seemed to me to have had more effect, sort of more visual effect than any other single feature film. And, you know, by then it was very encouraging. It was actually about 8 years before I went to see it. Because I just, you know, I kind of didn't want to know. When I did see it, I was kind of relieved because it wasn't really as great as I'd imagined it would be in terms of overall being a film. It just looks, it looks fabulous. And I think I'll take one more question because I'm rambling and making increasingly less sense, and then I'll sign your books.
Okay, the last question, all the way in the back there.
I was just wondering, what do you like to read when and if you have time? What are you drawn to?
Well, the thing I've read in the last 2 weeks that I most like, and actually the thing I've read in the last several months that I most like, is a book-length prose poem by D.J. Waldie, W-A-L-D-I-E, called Holy Land, which is a poem written by a man who grew up in the first suburb in California, the first suburb in America to actually have a mall. It was like the first suburb as we mean suburb, which Levittown wasn't because it didn't have a mall. And Waldie has lived there all his life, and his parents are dead, and he lives in his parents' house. And he wrote this astonishing poem about place in a place that's like there's no there there, or that's what we think. And I just read it because the host of a radio show I did recommended it to me, and I went to Book Soup and picked it up, and it's just fantastic. But other than that, When I'm writing fiction, I can't read fiction. So I read nonfiction, and I read a lot of history. I can, when I'm writing fiction, read Ian Sinclair and Peter Aykroyd, who are two favorite writers of mine. And Sinclair is kind of semi-fiction, but I don't know. But yeah, read Holy Land. It's really incredibly cool and very short. It's really just one poem. And thank you all for coming and being a lovely audience.
Thank you, William Gibson. Just a few issues with the signing. If you have more than 5 books, we're going to ask you to get in the line again in order to expedite the signing. So the first time through, 5 books would be the maximum. And Mr. Gibson will personalize books.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.